This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner. It's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm coming to you from the Toronto International Film Festival, where I have seen so many movies over the past couple of days. And one of them was Dumb Money, the movie from Craig Gillespie about the GameStop stock frenzy, which happened in January of 2021. And I lived through that, obviously, but didn't remember it all that well. And this movie is an incredibly entertaining and, you know, at some points rage-inducing look at the income inequality that made something like this happen. It opened on Friday night in Toronto. Played really great for the crowd. It's about to come to theaters, so everyone's going to get a chance to see it. And I really liked talking to Craig about threading together this massive story and about some of the choices that they made that are surprising and I think make it so interesting, including casting Seth Rogen as a hedge fund guy who maybe you should hate, but if it's Seth Rogen, he's less hateable and that makes it more interesting, and making a movie set in January of 2021 so you have characters who are wearing masks and are trying not to take public transit and all these things that we've moved on from and might have happily forgotten about, but are really important for telling the story. Craig's lovely. He's really, you know, explains well the realities of making films and how he was supposed to make another film that the financing fell through and kind of why he makes something that he never expected to make and what's good about making movies that surprise you. So let's hear my conversation with Dumb Money director Craig Gillespie. Craig Gillespie, thank you so much for joining to talk to me. We were just saying how I'm still in Toronto. You have left. You're a veteran of the festival. It's a weird year. You know, normally you would be taking the stage at the premiere with like the 15 stars of your movie, something like that.
Yes, there are a lot of people. I was very, very lucky to get this cast together. But yeah. It was really, you know, it's really hard not to have them. And to be able to share this because it's such a moment, you know, with all this hard work and collaboration we've all done together and put into it. But interestingly, it's kind of so timely because this film is all about the disparity of wealth and the frustration and wanting to be heard and feeling like the system's rigged against them. And you know, that is what's going on right now.
Yeah. I mean, so I, Tanya, came here and was such a huge audience hit. And you come back with a movie that's about power to the people in a really specific way. And I wonder what that audience response felt like. Maybe that was different from the last time you were here.
It's a bit of an out-of-body experience every time you're there. I have no real sense. It's like I sat there in the theater with I, Tanya, and as soon as it finished, I turned to my wife and said, I don't think that went well. And she's like, no, I think it was okay. It's so hard to know what's going on. This was literally the first time I've seen the film completely finished.
Wow.
And I have to see it with 1,000 people. So it was kind of, you know, it's very wild. It's very nerve wracking, but there is such a movement that this movie is about, you know, with the 8 million people mm-hmm. and wanting to be heard in this collective voice. So to be able to be in a theater and feel that energy and that frustration and that anger in a real like way was incredibly gratifying.
Yeah. Was it a rush to the finish line to finish? Is that why it was the first time you'd seen it complete?
The thing that honestly was slowing it down, which is way too much getting into the mechanics, was just the visual effects.
Oh, sure.
There's surprisingly so many screenshots in this film. You know.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the presence, not just of everyone being on their screens, but the use of memes for storytelling. Like, I think there have been other movies that have used internet language and memes before, but I don't think it's ever been as prominent and as important to the story as it in this movie. You can't tell the GameStop story without Reddit memes, really, which is not easy for everyone to understand. And I know your son was involved in this, so maybe you had that sense of language from that. But like, when you decide to make those so central to your story, and it's so specific to understand why you would have like a meme with HODL instead of spelling hold correctly, like that specific. How did you figure out how to make that part of the story and make it clear to people who maybe don't know anything about this?
Interestingly, yes, my son was very much a part of this, and he was living with us during COVID. He's 24 at the time. And so I got to see this firsthand, and he would come downstairs and show us these memes, you know, and these tweets like from Elon Musk and the outrage or the response that was happening within all of this. In fact, the one meme he came down at one point and he's like, if you're making a movie about this, this is the number one meme on Wall Street Bets right now, which was the guy drinking his own urine. You know, it's like, this has to be in the film.
Yeah.
And you see it in the scene with Gabe Pluck and looking at it, and like, you know, because that's what was happening at the time. But the memes is so integral to this because it's how this community would interact and it's how they would come together. And it also showed you the spirit and the exuberance with which this was all happening, as well as the frustration. So it was a very bizarre thing, but we got together a team of people to collect everything they could find that was happening at that moment with the memes, also with the news anchors, the talk show hosts, like from every aspect. And it was critical to feel the scale of this. And one way of doing that was with this conversation that was happening through memes, the amount of people chiming in, the amount of comments. And so it was very integral to the storyline. And trying to figure out where to put it, how much of it, like, you know, where it was necessary, that was a bit of an evolution.
Yeah. And there's something too, right, that they have, you know, the language of finance is so opaque, and that's part of what they're fighting against. And that kind of as a response, the people of Reddit have created their own language that Gabe Pluck can't possibly understand. Like, it's a form of rebellion, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, and they're very deliberately not playing by their rules. And it's like, I think part of the frustration and part of what was hard for the Wall Street community to get wrapped their heads around was their logic, because they're not playing the game the same way. Mm-hmm. And, there is comments where you see some of the CNN anchors talking, saying you need to go to the site, you need to hear what they're saying. You know, it was just a very different approach to what was happening.
Yeah. And so I know you make a movie with the studio. There's a vast legal department to make sure that everything is on the up and up. But my understanding is that some of the richer people depicted in this movie are maybe not thrilled with how they're being shown. How much do you concern yourself with that when you're making the movie? Do you kind of want them to be pissed off, but in a legal way? Like, what, how do you let that get to you?
Well, Rebecca and Angelo and Lon Shakabloom were Wall Street journalists, investigative reporters. So the tenacity with which they investigated everything and verified everything along the way, because we knew we were dealing with large entities here, and we had to make sure that we were being true to the actual events. We're not trying to like mischaracterize anything. The facts speak for themselves, and we just wanted to make sure we got it right. And then from that, you understand like why there was all of this frustration and anger and the sense of feeling marginalized and having a system rigged against you. Because once you go through the blow by blow of what actually happened, that's the natural reaction to it. Mm-hmm. So we expect it, because we're delving into a very complicated subjects here, that there would be people that would, you know, not be entirely happy about it. But on the flip side, the interesting part of this film, and yes, it's like there's this large group, it's like the 99% of our population that this was a mouthpiece for, but because we're trying to stay very accurate to the truth of it, it becomes a very subjective experience. So I believe and the hope is, And having spoken to some people in the banking community, as far as they're concerned, it's like, you know, what they're doing is legal, and it's within the bounds of the law, and they're allowed to do it, and they're just using the system the way it's been created. And so there's this sort of a completely different perspective for them. Mm-hmm. And so when they watch the film, we're portraying that. It's just from the other perspective, that's what's so outrageous about it. But for them, that's business as usual.
Yeah, just because it's legal doesn't mean you can't be mad about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's so it's a different experience for the banking community, but I think they relate to it in a different way. Like, mm-hmm. It's like this was a very like incredibly intense, unusual experience that happened. It's nice to have a little bit of perspective and see it from both sides, I'm sure, for them. But it's like the drive for this and the frustration and the, you know, and really what we're trying to accomplish is this sense of outrage that's going on in the country. And this was a beginning of that dialogue.
Yeah. I wouldn't say this movie is not pro-bank in any way. As you say, you're capturing that outrage. But as you're kind of two big heavyweight finance guys, you've got Nick Offerman and Seth Rogen, who are really likable actors. Every other time you see them in a movie, basically, you're so happy to see them. And that did feel like a deliberate choice that, you know, we're seeing Gabe Plotkin with his wife. We're seeing their struggles, with air quotes. But
yes.
I wonder why that was a choice for you, why they didn't need to just be like bad guys in suits, that there's more to those two characters.
I think it's just too easy to just vilify mm-hmm. and have a black and white story. It's like, you know, like everybody thinks that they're doing the right thing for the most part, unless they're like psychotic, you know? So to be able to understand that these are human beings, this is like people's lives, you know, even though it's like all of this stuff is happening online and everybody's attacking an individual, it's a person, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like, it's sometimes like, to be able to step back and realize that, and it's much more about the institution than the individual. We just wanted to be fair to that. It was important to show, yeah. like, you know, show that and have that humanity in there. So, you know, Seth was a deliberate choice, but I love when you get an actor that can play against type. You know, mm-hmm. it's not what's expected. And he gets his surprises in that way. But there is this humanity to him that I thought was important to have.
Did you ask him and Nick Offerman both to just like play their guys as if they think they're the good guys? Is that how you, you know, help a actor craft that kind of performance?
We didn't get that specific on it, but it's like this is their daily life. Like as hedge fund guys, mm-hmm. this is, you know, they're looking for opportunities, ways to make money, like trades that they can do. And it's like part of the frustration, you know, in our country is these moves that they make, this like shorting of large corporations that can send them bankrupt, affects the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. And that allocation of bandwidth for them doesn't seem to, you know, to be there in that community. So mm-hmm. I think from their level, they're just operating in a different headspace.
Yeah, it's like they move one thing and it affects millions of people, but they don't even know.
Yeah.
And they would never
understand
otherwise
those consequences.
Know.
Yeah.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So, you know, you've talked about how when, you know, your son was involved in this, you know, it's January 2021, everyone's in lockdown. But I was thinking about, you know, Cruella's coming out right around then. Like, where were you as a director when this was happening and then this film coming to you? Like, what did that movie make you want to look for? What made this feel like the right thing? How much control do you have over what you're choosing? And, you know, coming out of the pandemic and having this be your post-pandemic movie, it's a choice because you're going right back in there. So, like, how did that fit in your, you know, what you wanted for yourself?
It's a house of cards, the whole Hollywood system of what's going to get made and not get made. It's like, and even this film, it's like, it looks like it's going to get made. It's not getting made. It's almost getting made. We almost lost, you know, lost the financing. It's constant. It's so tenuous. But what was happening at the time, I think I was probably finishing up Cruella editorially when this was happening mm-hmm. at home,
yeah.
cutting at home, living in with it with my son. But actually, I was developing a script Chippendales with Rebecca and Lauren, the writers. A couple of months after this event, we were talking constantly about GameStop because of how I lived through it with my son. And it was a very visceral, you know, experience. And I was always curious about that, what was going on with that. But we were only 2 or 3 months out from what we thought was going to be our next feature. Mm-hmm. Financing was set up, was, you know, doing casting, and Seth was attached, actually. And then suddenly it imploded. Mm-hmm. So the next day, Rebecca and Lauren sent this script over. Wow. And I just consumed it like that evening. And it absolutely captured everything I was feeling, and just the trajectory of it, the tension of it, the intensity, the frustration. And I think partly too, because I'd lived it so viscerally with my son that I translated that into the script, and that was what I really wanted to capture. So that's how it came together. And then it came together very quickly.
Does that, so, you know, you've made independent films long enough to like have the finance collapsing, the finance talks, like you're dealing with the banking system in that way, which is really interesting and not how most people interact with it. But I wonder if like independent filmmakers really have that frustration because of how much power the banking types have over what kind of art you can make. It feels like such a crazy trade-off when you think about it.
Actually, well, the interesting thing, like the trade-off in the independent world for me is you don't have quite the same amount of money, but I'm in a fortunate place where I have complete freedom.
Yeah.
So Black Bear, who financed this, was incredibly supportive. And at that point, I got to do an Ice Hunter as well. I get to run, go with my instincts, trust my actors, and cast the people I want, make the changes we want to the script, like really, really just keep our eye on the creative. That's exhilarating. It's done very quickly, but it's exhilarating.
When you say quickly, so finance comes together and like, what, a year later, you've got a movie made? Is that about how fast this was?
Yeah, but quickly, even in the sense of like, so we, like Rebecca and Lauren sent me the script. Even from when they wrote it till I got it, the congressional hearing had happened, but it wasn't in the script.
Yeah.
And it was probably only about 3 months till we were shooting. So very quickly, you know, and then there was only, I think, 6 weeks of actual prep, like on the ground, finding locations. So very quickly, we're like, I think that congressional hearing is the heart of the film. And to see, like, when you look at Keith Gill's testimony and the journey that he's on, and he's this lone person that's been grilled by Congress up against all of these corporations and trying to be made a scapegoat out of it. And it's like, it's exactly the frustration that everybody's talking about, and that he leaned in and held his ground. It's like, that's our journey. And so they very quickly, you know, rewrote that. But then that trickles through the whole movie, because then halfway through he's getting subpoenaed. And as I sat down with Paul Dano for that 6 weeks leading up to it, we started really digging in and being like, all right, hang on a second. So at this point in time, he's just lost $30 million in 48 hours. We found like this photograph of him waving outside of his house in the Daily Mail, you know, right around when he got subpoenaed. It's like, what's happening in his house right now? Like, these are incredibly life-changing, stressful moments. So all of these things would be just adding in real time, you know. And then Pete Davidson was dying on and be like, oh, let's have a scene with Pete and Paul. And Rebecca and Lauren would do their research and be like, all right, so Kevin Gill did run naked when he was in college for a mile in a thunderstorm. So we create a scene around that, you know?
Not just a scene, it's like a running sequence of the film. That's like a big thematic element.
Yes. So it was that part of it was really exciting to be able to be that nimble. With Rebecca and Lauren, and then with the actors, and just really make it this creative process.
Yeah. I noticed, and I think I'm right, that Keith Gill's child is never named, that you see the baby, but there's no name for it. And it felt, when I get to the end and you see that he's kind of like left public life, it made it feel like that was a deliberate effort to helping his privacy. What else did you guys have to do? Because he clearly wants to be a private citizen now, but this movie exists. So how do you navigate that? Yeah.
It's always a complicated situation, but what we really, really tried to honor was drawing from everything that he's posted. Mm-hmm. So if he'd had a dialogue about it, if he's talked about things that had been in his post, that's what we would draw from. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't, we would try and honor that as much as possible. So that was sort of a touchstone for us. And even, you know, Paul was such a gatekeeper to that. It'd be like, well, he didn't actually say it like this. can we just change that dialogue? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and be like, absolutely, because, you know, we really wanted to get it right. Like down to the opening post of him, where it's like, nice shirt, grandpa, and nerd in all caps. That's literally his opening post. You know, those shirts that he's wearing, Cameron Lennox, our custom designer, found the artist that creates those and found the exact shirts.
You know? Wow, that's cool.
So the research was there. And then because they are real, you know, real people, we want to try and be as right as possible.
Do you know if he or any of the other real people have seen the movie?
We've reached out to Keith during the shoot, so forth. There's been no response. So ultimately, we just want to respect his privacy and not push that in any way. Yeah. Not sure about the other people. The movie's coming out this weekend. I think we may find out.
The time you might see the tweets one way or another. Yes. When you did a first look with us a couple months ago for this film, and you were talking about the weirdness of shooting it, where you've got, you know, 15 different movies basically, because each actor is really on their own in their pockets. I mean, I assume that's the first time you've worked like that in your career. What do you have to adjust to as a director to make a movie in that way?
For me, it was I've done a lot of commercials over the years. So that's a very short story in a very condensed period of time. And I could bring that tool, I think, like quite easily to this. So there was a fun aspect to it. But the bizarreness is, except for Pete and Paul and Shailene, nobody's really in a scene together. Yeah. Everybody is completely isolated because by the nature of COVID. And they are coming in and they've got their whole own location, their whole environment, and their set of characters around them. So, and with the exception of Paul, no prep time, because we had very complicated schedules with these actors. You know, Anthony had these 3 days. Pete was shooting a show at the same time. It's like, so trying to interweave that scheduling. So they'd have to come in and understand a very tricky tone because they're all in the same film. Mm-hmm. And feel like it's cohesive, but they're all actors that either I've worked with, I've wanted to work with, like Pete and Anthony. We were attached to a movie together that fell apart, a different film.
It's a theme.
I know. So it's like, so they're all actors that work in this space, this tone that I really, really enjoy working in, which is this dance with the humor and the drama that's got real emotional stakes. And so they can all deliver on that. Like America Ferrera, I had not worked with, but I'd seen it so often in her work and that dance that she can do. And I was so excited to get her because she's really the mouthpiece for the have-nots in the film, the really frustrated, the marginalized. And you need that ferocity. You need that anger and that resentment, you know, that to be represented, but you also need to do it with a deft touch and with some humor that can walk that line and keep her accessible, you know, and she killed it.
Yeah. You can't make this movie without acknowledging COVID. Obviously it's so important to why it happened in real life and when the movie's set, but you do have a choice in like, you can set scenes inside so no one has to have masks on and you can have it be less obvious, but I love how central standing 6 feet apart from a stranger and keeping your mask on and off, like that's become so much of the story. So how did you guys figure out how much to put that in there without everyone being like, I don't want to see masks anymore, get it away from me, because we're not eager to revisit it, but it's important.
It was incredibly important to me to have the audience be aware of this moment in time, because it was COVID that made this happen. It's like, you know, we were isolated. There was a huge disruption going on with people losing their jobs, their financing, the incredible health scare, the loss of lives, the social unrest with Black Lives Matter, people trying to connect online, the disparity of wealth becoming very acutely obvious, like with the postings of social media and this real sense and awareness of that disparity. All of that was because of what we were living through with COVID.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, this voice, this rallying of 8 million people, it happened to be around a stock. There's like, there needed to just be an outlet. And suddenly there was this opportunity to really stick it to the one percenters, or in this case, like the 0.01 percenters, and be heard and hit them where it hurts. And so to be able to channel that, it happened to be a stock. It's like it was happening elsewhere. It was happening with protests, with Black Lives Matter. But this was one vehicle to do that. So, and it was all because of COVID. So trying to like remind people of what that was, and to remind them of that experience and that isolation and that yearning to connect and this and just the fear that was involved with all that was critical. When it got to the actual mechanics of it and we started shot listing, and I turned to my DP and I'm like, oh shit, they're going to be wearing a mask in this scene. We're not going to be able to see their face. <I know. laughs> what do we do about that? And so there were these tricks that we were in play. You know, you meet Paul for the first time on the train. I'm like, have a cup of coffee so we can take a sip and see it's you, you know?
That, but like that specifically, everyone I know was like, oh, I remember doing that. I remember having, like, to pull it down and take a drink. It's so evocative and also practical.
Yeah. And then we're in a hospital. It's like, there's no way they're going to take their masks off during COVID. So we have to put them like in an enclosed space eating, having a lunch break, you know, where they've pulled their masks down so that we can have this, you know, a scene between the two actors. So
it was,
and then the other choices, like the other opportunities in terms of this wealth disparity, to see the very wealthy with their staff all in masks and they're not in masks, you know, that contradiction, to see Florida having a party and nobody's wearing masks. You know, you had all these opportunities to comment on the politics that were going on in a very subtle way.
Yeah. Do you ever worry that audiences are going to see this and be like, I can't revisit that time in my life. Like, get me out of there.
I loved the opportunity that we could look at it and we could capture it. And because it's such a profound moment for all of us. It's like a time when life was put on pause and you had to like reevaluate it. And I think it's completely changed our culture. It's changed the way that people look at what's their value system is, what's important to them, the balance of work and life, that I don't think there's any turning back from it now.
Yeah.
So I was excited to be able to like look at that, even though it was so recently.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So I asked you how Cruella and then the pandemic made you think about what you wanted to make next. How does making this movie make you think about what you want to make next? What did you learn from on this that you want to do again or never want to do again?
I tend to try and just stay as open as possible. It's, you know, I think trying too hard to figure out your direction is just too limiting. It's like I wasn't expecting to make a film about this. I wasn't expecting to do Dumb Money. But then with the confluence of events, they came together and the material just spoke to me. It's like, ultimately it's always about the material. So it could be Cruella 2. It could be another independent film. It's like, it's something that I can read it. I can connect with it. And then I know how I want to shoot it.
Well, it means you'll never be bored because you never know what you're going to make next. That's
no,
pretty
it's
good.
True. It's you know, I just take it at the core level of like, am I excited to tell this story? You know, because it's a lot of a commitment to do this for a year or two, as long as it takes, and you got to get up every day and do these 16-hour days. So you better want to get up and do it.
That does it for today's show. We'll be back on Thursday talking about so many of the highlights of Toronto. Find us in the meantime on Twitter and Instagram at VF Awards Insider. We've got a festival live blog going at vanityfair.com so you can see all of our updates from the festivals. You can follow me on Twitter at Katie Rich. Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
and why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.